Lizzie Borden took an axe, gave her mother 40 whacks when she saw what she had done, gave her father 41.
Exactly.
Like that.
This is the Lizzie Borden Podcast with your host, Richard Barons, Episode 2. Welcome to the Lizzie Borden Podcast, a Nine Muses Books production, Episode 2, Sarah Miller on the Borden Murders. Hi, this is Richard Barons, and welcome to the second episode of the Lizzie Borden Podcast. In our first episode, I explored that piece of doggerel that almost everybody knows, Lizzie Borden took an axe, etc. As I explained, everything in this little song is wrong, either inaccurate or unproved. So going to that rhyme as a source of information about the Borden murders of 1892 in particular, and Lizzie Borden in general, is a complete waste of time. Unfortunately, this doggerel contains most people's sole knowledge about the Borden murders. So what I've decided to do in the early episodes of this podcast is to lay out the known facts of Lizzie Borden's life and times, as well as the murders, the investigation, and the trial. This will amount to a beginner's guide to Lizzie Borden, or as I call it, a Lizzie Borden primer. Joining me today is Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century, published this year by Random House Children's Books. Sarah Miller is the author of two historical fictional novels, Miss Spitfire, Reaching Helen Keller, which was called an accomplished debut in a starred review from Booklist and was named an ALA-ALSC Notable Children's Book, and The Lost Crown, about the Romanoffs, hailed as fascinating in a starred review from Kirkus Reviews and named an ALA-YALSA Best Book for Young Adults. The Borden Murders is her first nonfiction book. Today we are going to meet Sarah and talk about her book, The Borden Murders, which I can't speak more highly about. It is a clear and concise telling of the Fall River tragedy and the subsequent trial. Sarah's objective approach and historical precision makes her book the perfect introduction to anyone interested in Lizzie Borden. The Lizzie Borden primer will start with episode 3, but first let's meet Sarah Miller, author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden, and the Trial of the Century. Hey, hi, Sarah. Hi, how are you doing?
Pretty super. How are you?
Fine. Have you found the murder weapon yet on Second Street?
No, but is it weird that I have a hatchet in my car?
It's only weird if the handle is snapped off.
Well, the handle is cracked, but it's not broken yet.
Okay. Many Lizzie Borden investigators often go out there and they, you know, look both ways to make sure no one's looking, and then they go buy a hatchet, and then they try it out in the backyard just to see what it's like.
I might have done that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking about your book, The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century. Why did you decide at this point, after writing about Helen Keller and writing about the Romanoffs, why did you decide to write a book about Lizzie Borden?
I don't know exactly how it happened. I can remember reading about Lizzie Borden like 20 years ago when I was pushing a cart through the library and supposed to be putting books away. I had laid Alan Brown, I think his name is.
Arnold Brown.
His book, Arnold Brown, that's the guy. I laid his book open to the inquest testimony on my cart, so as I'm pushing along, I was reading questions and answers. So I know I was interested in Lizzie that long ago, but it totally creaked me out, and then I had to sleep with the lights on for like a week.
The inquest testimony was probably the only part of his book that had any truth to it.
Yes, I agree. How I got back toward Lizzie, I don't know. How I got to a point where I could read it without sleeping with the lights on, I don't know, but I did. And the more I looked around, the more I looked deeper into primary sources and found out how little is actually known about Lizzie herself, and then looked at what we think about Lizzie and how we view Lizzie. That's when I kind of went, wow, there's a huge gap between these two poles. How? Why? That's what got me into learning more, more, more.
Was this before the publication of Parallel Lives by the Fall River Historical Society?
I think so, yes, because when that book came out, I remember like, oh, I need that. I need to scrape a lot of dollars together and get that book. Well, you know what? Theirs is so detailed and comprehensive, and the information is spread about Lizzie, is spread throughout the book as it pertains to various pieces of the culture and the history. But somebody who sits down and says, I just want to read about Lizzie Borden, they can't achieve that with that book. They can learn more than they will ever learn about Lizzie with that book.
And it is also a very good history of Fall River, especially from Lizzie Borden's time period. It was written by historians, Fall River historians, so they took the opportunity to also write an excellent book about Fall River history. And Fall River does have a very rich history that's worth reading about. You know, another quality of your book that I admired very much was the objectivity. You limited yourself to Lizzie and the crime and the trial, and you were probably a lot more objective than most books that I've read. A lot of books about Lizzie Borden tend to try to make money by trying to solve the case. So you have your Emma Did It books and your Bridget Did It books and your Uncle John Did It books. And those books, they tend to be biased towards their own theory rather than just include a chapter of possible theories.
Yeah, it dictates what they emphasize and what they leave out because they have to. If you're going to present a theory, that's what you have to do. You have to say, this one little thing that everybody overlooked is the key to everything. And there's probably some little piece somewhere that is that key, but I don't think we found it.
You were very precise, and you have an introduction where you explain your working methodology. I was wondering if you could comment a little bit on this. I'm referring to stuff like when you were doing correction of spellings, you know, like clue being spelled as C-L-E-W. And you finding different variants on quotes like, oh, Mrs. Churchill, do come over. You indicated the choices that you had to make. And at some point you said something very eloquent in the book where you go, I realize that I could openly say we don't know what happened. But you can present, as an historian, you can present these two subjective accounts. Could you say a little bit about that?
The continuity was something that I kind of stumbled upon when I started, you know, actually typing things up and putting things side by side. For example, inquest testimony versus preliminary hearing testimony versus the trial. The main witnesses who were on the scene initially, like Mrs. Churchill, Dr. Bowen, Alice Russell, they all say, they all convey pretty much the same information every time, but they say it maybe a little differently. And even if they say it the same way, like in the case of, oh, Mrs. Churchill, do come over, somebody has killed father, two different people filling that role in the courtroom, and they punctuate things differently. They capitalize or don't capitalize the word father. So if you're writing a book and you're talking about these different events and quoting from these different events without mentioning that kind of thing, you look kind of like a sloppy idiot because spellings vary, punctuations vary, but that's just how it was. People were less stringent at the time. The murder happened in 1892 in August, and the trial happened in 1893 in June. And in those intervening months, I guess was as the custom at the end of the year, police officers were promoted. And so their ranks change. So if I refer to somebody as an officer in the beginning of the book and somebody, the same somebody as a sergeant later on, it looks funny. So you have to say, this is the reason. It's not actually a goof. It's just that things change as time passes.
So it's almost as if as an historian, you're not presenting something as if it's an absolute fact. You're presenting something as if, based on the artifacts that we have extant, this is what we could approximate what happened.
Right. This is what's available to us. Like, even the trial testimony itself. Well, I'm not saying people are lying on the stand by any means. I think virtually everyone who got up on the stand told the truth to the best of their ability, the truth as they saw it, whatever, but people goof. People misinterpret things. There's no way to know what is completely accurate and what is skewed by somebody's opinions, by somebody's feelings, even by the newspaper articles they read in the months in between the event and the trial. In the decades since, people have studied this and have proven that depending on how you're questioned, your answers can change. Depending on what you've looked at in the media about this event that you were a witness to, your memories can change. Your memories are not solid things like, you know, a VHS tape that you stick in there and you just roll it, and it's always the same. You're reassembling.
And in spite of this, there is, as you pointed out yourself, there is a large degree of consistency in the testimony. That when you have Uncle John and Bridget testifying about what happened that morning before the murders, there is a degree of consistency. So tiny inconsistencies may not be significant.
Right. And the interesting thing is also the more fluid and straightforward a witness is in their style, the more you get an impression of consistency, regardless of whether or not it exists. If you try to actually plot out the timing of everything Bridget says, and she was the star witness for the prosecution. I said, she knows, you know, when everybody got up, when they brushed their teeth, when they latched or unlatched the screen door. But her testimony isn't perfect in the sense that you can plot it and everything else fits with it. There are gaps. There are things where you go, whoa, the timing doesn't seem quite right there. Like, how long was she washing that window? How long was she clearing that table? Did it really take her 10 minutes to go out in the yard and be sick? Because of the way that she delivered that information, people took it as the bedrock of the events of that day.
I'm aware that half of the inquest testimony is missing.
Yes.
Yeah, the half that's missing includes Lizzie Borden's only time that she testified under oath. And yes, that fortunately was printed in a newspaper, and that's how we have it. But the rest of the testimony that's in that half of the inquest is missing. And that's unfortunate because that was done within a week of the actual murders. That's when people's memories would have been the most fresh.
Right. That's like the primary source of all, and it's gone. And Bridget's testimony is gone. And in Bridget's case, there is no newspaper to reconstruct from. But fortunately, the prosecutor, Knowlton, said somewhere, I think he was writing maybe to the attorney general, said he considered her preliminary hearing testimony virtually identical to what she'd said at the inquest. So, I mean, that's the best we've got. And if he felt that way, like, all right, I guess I'm going to trust him. Even though he was on the side of the courtroom that I probably would not choose to sit on if I could go there. I believe he was an honorable man, so I trust his word. I'm really persnickety. I want to get it right. I want to tell you what we know for sure and let you decide. That was my whole outlook for this book. And there were times when looking at conflicting information, especially in the newspapers, where I thought, I don't know, and I'd get all in a bind, like, I don't know which one to put, and it would dawn on me, I don't have to say, this is the truth and this is the baloney. I could say, here are two opposing pieces of information, and we don't know which is correct. But I think that's important because it gives you a sense of the breadth of opinion and information that was out there that people were trying to figure out where they stood on this case. They had a lot to choose from. And to give that picture when you can't actually say, this is the thing that happened, I think there's still value in that.
So in preparing for this book, it's clear that you've went through as much primary source material as you possibly could. And that includes the first police reports, police statements, the inquest testimony that we have, the preliminary hearings. The grand jury testimony, of course, is not available. But you read all, I forgot how many thousands of pages the actual trial transcript is, but you've went through all of it.
I did. I think I tallied up all of that primary courtroom material is like 2,500 pages or something. It's kind of awful to sit there and do it. But it is, because it quickly became clear to me when I started looking at the newspapers, like, this is hooey. A lot of the stuff, just right from the get-go, is plain hooey. So, okay, what was really said? Regardless of whether the people were correct, what did they actually say? And then how did the newspapers interpret it? And I'm glad that I read them in chronological order, too. That made a difference. If I had just started with the trial, I think I would have wrapped my head around it in a different way. I began with the witness statements and moved chronologically forward from there, which allowed me to get a sense of the momentum of the story. Because things do change, with Alice Russell in particular, who can remember almost nothing initially. And then by the time of the trial, 10 months later, one of her account of a visit she had from Lizzie the day before the murders feels like 5 pages of stenographer's paper. And I mean, they're small sheets of paper, I get that. But still, from Knowlton saying initially, is there anything you remember? When he sounds frustrated, we can't know because transcripts just don't give you that information. to suddenly she's just rattling off this entire conversation and whole paragraph is weird. Makes you wonder, what, how? You know, maybe she calmed down after the initial shock. Maybe she was able to piece it together, but it's a weird snowballing of her story.
And Alice Russell is a very important person in the story because it was her testimony about the dress, the burning of the dress, that really kind of changed everything at the grand jury proceedings. But we don't know that for a fact because we don't have the actual transcript. We know that they reconvened the grand jury to take Alice Russell's testimony, and that made all the difference in sending Lizzie Borden to trial in the Superior Court.
The information that's available to us certainly makes it sound as if her information was the information that swayed them into indicting her.
And I assume that there's no evidence that Alice Russell and Lizzie Borden ever spoke to each other again.
Not that I'm aware of.
So after the primary source material, you used a whole bunch of existing Lizzie Borden books. Were there any that you considered to be the most important ones for your research?
Those that were most useful to me tended to be like the Lizzie Borden source book.
Yeah, the David Kent?
Yes, which is, you know, just a compilation of newspaper articles. In terms of books with an actual narrative structure, I would have to say Kent, again, I think is the most objective, although I disagree with some of his interpretations of particular pieces of evidence. I think he, more than anybody else, tried not to solve it, just tried to say what had happened. And I think he was more fair toward Lizzie Borden herself than many other authors have been.
And then, of course, there's Parallel Lives.
Tremendous. That book changed my whole frame of reference about Lizzie Borden herself and what kind of person. That's when I started to see her as a person, not a Halloween costume or a bobblehead, because of the information about her later life and how she interacted with people, how she treated people. You know, and even what they describe, photographs, and the detail, I remember one of Emma as a child talking about the significance of, you know, the fabric and the pattern that indicated in line with current fashion. Was she behind? Was the jewelry what a girl of 12 would usually wear? Or was, you know, did that indicate something? It was just like, wow. You know, I would just look at a picture and say, oh, well, that's Emma. Neat.
So two books that you mention, you do caveat in the book that they're a bit misleading, but they're worth looking at. One is Edwin H. Porter's The Fall River Tragedy, and the other is Victoria Lincoln's A Private Disgrace, Lizzie Borden by Daylight. Could you elaborate on why you caveated that with the books maybe misleading?
Is it Pearson or Porter? I get those two. It was Pearson that I get grumpy about. Pearson, written in the 1930s, was an overview of the trial. He started with, what, maybe 100 pages of his narrative of the crime and the trial, which is not bad. I disagree with him here and there, but I disagree with mostly everybody on something here or there. And then the trial itself is smushed into the sort of newspaper format where they would compile answers that were just yes-no type stuff. Instead of preserving that Q&A, he would just put up these big paragraphs of, like, storytelling and excuse how the trial reads. Interesting thing, when the copy editing was going on for my book, the copy editor's job is to make sure you've, you know, quoted everything correctly to the extent that they're able to access the information you had access to. So this copy editor had found, I think it was a law school in Kansas, has what is billed as trial testimony online. And you would think a law school would be a reliable place to get information. And it turns out, because she kept noting places where my quotes didn't match what appeared to her to be trial testimony, which, you know, is worrisome if you're a copy editor. And when I looked at it, I realized that university had put up Pearson's version, not the actual trial.
Oh, that's tragic.
And I went, holy cats, yeah, that's just awful.
That is bad.
Yeah, she was like, oh. And then I understood, you know, of course, if you were not familiar with the case, you would presume that this is a reliable place to get that information, and it turned out not to be at all.
Right, the downloadable PDFs from Stephanie Corey's website are very reliable. I think that she worked with Kat Corey and Harry Widows to put all that together. And it's, from my understanding, that it's extremely reliable.
Yeah, that's what I use. And when I think about how it used to be to research something like this, you would have to turn every page of paper with your hand and skim with your own eyeballs, find the detail that you needed. Whereas with these PDFs, I could type in swordfish, and it would bring up swordfish instantly, which was magical and saved, I can't imagine how much time. How would you even begin to track all of that information in a pre-digital format?
Well, I met Harry Widows once, and I asked him that, and his only answer was, ugh.
That's exactly what I would envision, yeah.
He said, I'm retired now. I never
when
again.
I realized what it was like for people before to research this, then I had to be, frankly, a little less snotty about other people's mistakes.
Now, did you have the chance to visit Fall River while researching the book?
Yes, I drove out to Fall River, I want to say in October of 13, I think. I was only there for, I was there one night there and one night in Fairhaven, but I stayed at the Lizzie Borden Bed and Breakfast.
Oh, nice. Which room did you stay in?
Lizzie's bedroom.
Oh, nice.
Which was, yeah. That was the only room that really appealed to me. I'm too chicken for the murder room.
It is a very nice room.
It is, yeah. And the thing about that house that was so interesting, I mean, I live in an old house. My house was built in 1873, so I'm accustomed to old houses. But you hear again and again and again how cramped and dim and dark and awful and oppressive this house was. And I walked into this place and I went, this is bigger than my house. And it's got windows that are not quite floor to ceiling, but they're just nice, big windows. And I was in that place 90 seconds, and I thought, I'm going to be fine. There's nothing to be afraid of here. Now, the tour guide, whose job it is to tell ghost stories and creep me out, might be able to creep me out. But the house itself, even though, regardless of what you think about the afterlife, spiritual ghosts, energies, something terrible did in fact happen in that house. We have nasty pictures to prove it. But even that fact, I didn't feel uncomfortable in that house.
I did not feel that way either until a time I was in the basement when the lights went off.
Okay, I'll give you that.
And then I said, well, you know, I do believe in spooks. I do believe in spooks.
I do believe in spooks. Now, I was in there for about 30 minutes alone because the other guests had gone out to get supper or something. And I was from the cellar to the attic and was fine. But then, you know, all the lights stayed on. So, yeah, that might have drastically changed my opinion quickly.
Well, that's the thing. The mind can do weird things, and if you have strange thoughts in your head, being alone in the house could trigger a lot. You know, you start interpreting noises that you hear and shadows, and
yeah.
You know. But I've never had anything resembling a paranormal experience in that house. I've met people who have claimed, but they also claim to have experienced that elsewhere. So it might be something in their head that travels around with them, or it could be that there is residual energy there that is from the tragedy. I just don't have any personal experience or evidence to go on.
And it may be that people who are more sensitive to that are just more sensitive across locations. So they, you know, they're just more aware.
Who'd you have a chance to speak to when you went to Fall River? Did you go to the meet Michael Martins and Dennis Binet at the Historical Society?
Heck yes.
Oh, good.
And that was super. Yeah, I met them. I probably talked to them for, I want to say, a couple hours. At some point during that, a couple other people showed up for a tour, and they said, do you want to take a tour? And I said, yeah. So another man, I want to say his name was Keith or Ken. I can't remember. I've got it written down somewhere. He conducted the tour of all the artifacts and stuff, and that was super, super. And, you know, at one point, because at that time, the bedspread from the spare room was on display, and I turned around and I'm like, whoa, there it is. And it's much cleaner than you expect it to be, given what happened next to that bed. But Dennis was standing across from me, and I was like, I know. I said to him, I know you get to see this every day. You're probably used to this, but do you know what this is like? Turn around, and there is this thing.
And this is the first time it's been on display, and probably since the event happened, or the trial at least.
Forgive the goriness, but it is literally saturated in history.
And they have her hair braid that was found on
it. And little things I hadn't thought of when I saw them, it made sense. You know, there were envelopes from city marshal, you know, correspondence and like maybe the hair samples or something. But they had, of course they had, printed stationery that had his name and, you know, like a logo of the Fall River Police. And you just don't think of that so much in an email age, how things looked, how things physically felt in your hand, and it was all there. And a funny little thing, you know, they have the stool that was in Lizzie's jail cell, and Dennis pulled it out, you know, from under a cabinet so I could see it, and I was like, I want to touch that. I want to sit on it. It's not allowed, but I want to. And then I thought, you just slept in the woman's bedroom. Do you think you might have touched something that she touched? I think you'll be okay if you don't put your hiney on that stool.
Right. Yeah, and they have her dinner pail as well, I believe, from her her sojourn in the jail.
And her meatloaf recipe, which made me laugh right out loud.
Oh, they have that on display? The index card with I've seen a picture
of that. At that time they did. And I'm often a poor sport about Lizzie Borden jokes, but I just hooted right out loud when I saw that. I think it was Dennis said to me, it's actually not very good.
Well, she didn't, you know, she probably was just giving someone a meatloaf recipe. It's as simple as that. How important do you feel Fall River is to an understanding of the Lizzie Borden case?
I think it's significant. I'm weaker on Fall River history in general than I would like to be, especially after having been there and seen the place and seen how much more it is than Lizzie Borden. I mean, I didn't even know Battleship Cove was there until I arrived in the city and saw a poster. Because the public awareness of Fall River is so narrow because Lizzie Borden, that's all there is. But I think there is sort of a funny sort of misconception that it was a small town, and maybe that's because of the way the investigation was handled. But we're talking, what, 85,000 people in 1892?
It was a very large town for that time, yeah. In the decade previous to the murders, the Borden murders, there was a big explosion of new textile mills and new businesses in Fall River. So it was in Lizzie Borden's lifetime as an adult, the city itself was growing exponentially and was undergoing like a second growth of industry.
Well, and how stratified the society was. You know, there were the very, very rich people who owned the mills and the very, very unrich who worked in them. And Lizzie's sort of in a funny position in between them because of where she lived as opposed to where they could have afforded to live. They were living so modestly that it just sort of put her in a sort of no man's land, I think.
Yeah, she did a lot of work for her church and for various organizations, but she never really had a job or a career.
No, and she had no need to financially. I mean, for a woman of that time and that place, what would have been available to her? She was kind of too well off to be a teacher. What else would there have been?
Marriage.
Yeah.
But there's no hint that she was ever courted by anybody or that she ever took an interest in anybody.
No. And I did ask at the Historical Society, I asked Michael and Dennis, was there any indication either way, positive or negative, that either of the Borden girls desired to be married? And they said, no, there is no indication. So we really do not know why they were not married. If that was by choice, by circumstance, were they content with that situation or were they not? We have no indication whatsoever.
Or whether Andrew had any influence on that in dissuading people or negatively reinforcing anybody from wanting to take an interest in them?
Because the prevailing opinion nowadays is, well, if a woman at that time wasn't married, there had to be a reason. No? I don't know.
Yeah, one other very important aspect of your book, I think, is a lot of the careful way in you dealt with a lot of the legends surrounding Lizzie Borden. The urban legends, all the myths, like the myth of Andrew Borden.
That was really what I had the most fun with, was looking at those myths.
Yeah, Andrew Borden being the wealthiest man in town, the stingiest man in town.
Yeah.
Being a child abuser, a wife abuser. You know, the fact that there are no real hallways separating the rooms in the house was due to his stinginess rather than due to the original design of the house before he bought it.
Yeah. There's no hallways in my house. You know, what does that mean?
Well, I think the consensus is that when he bought 92 Second Street, he actually opened it up.
Yeah, he sure did.
He knocked down a couple of walls. He rearranged things. He made it cozier. He made it less cramped. Now, you mention it in a sidebar. You have very good sidebars in your books. I found some material in your book that I had never encountered before. And one of them, well, you did an excellent job. There's something in your book where you mention that they were considering a move to the Hill. Or there was actually a real estate agent who was acting on for Andrew Borden, actually looking for a house on the Hill.
Yep.
Do you remember where you got that from?
I first heard that in a telephone conversation with Michael Martin. He mentioned that. And if I recall correctly, that information he had found, I think, in Jennings' journals, which they had recently acquired. It came up again while I was in Fall River in person. And then I found it also in Lizzie's jailhouse interview with Kate Swan McGurk, I think was the reporter's name. It was a woman that she had known from her charity work, and she was, I believe, the only person, reporter, that Lizzie was willing to speak to while she was incarcerated. and that reporter brought that fact up, which, you know, in a newspaper interview, especially one with Lizzie herself, given how full of baloney the newspapers were, you really have to think, So if I hadn't heard that information also at the Historical Society in Fall River, I might have dismissed it.
Right. And you also mentioned information about how Andrew did have desires to upgrade his house.
Yes.
But the girls were concerned about having to rip up the floorboards for the piping.
Yeah, and Parallel Lives is very good about that, too. They point out, here is when running water became available in the city, and here is when Andrew Borden hooked up his businesses and his home. Now, he didn't include the second floor in his plumbing, but okay. He took advantage of that luxury very quickly. Not only at home, but with his businesses. Gas lights, he wasn't quite so keen on, apparently. But again, Parallel Lives points out that that was not unusual. People were uncomfortable initially with gas lights, as we would be now when you think about, you know, fire. Here's a lamp with fire in it that's connected to a city line rather than just a kerosene lamp. People were more comfortable with kerosene lamps, probably because they had control over them.
Yeah, same thing with electricity, because we know that at that time, I mean, that Martins and Binet were very good at pointing out that at that time, electricity was available and parts of the city were being electrified, but it certainly wasn't something that had become common in domestic houses. If Andrew Borden did not have electricity in his house, it was not out of the ordinary. It didn't make him an Ebenezer Scrooge by not putting electric lights in his house.
And I get a kick out of comparing Mr. Borden to my grandpa. My grandpa on my dad's side just died last year. He was 100 years old. He was born in Nebraska in 1915. He was one of, I believe, six brothers. His father died when he was very young. So here's his mother trying to run a farm with six boys, which is good because, you know, you've got boys to help out. When they killed the chicken, everybody had like a designated piece of the chicken that was theirs to eat. And grandpa's was the head, you know. And this man, you know, last year was still wearing garments that I recognized from my childhood because they were still serviceable garments. So there was no reason for him to discard them. He was not interested in fashion, but he wasn't stingy by any means. He was quite generous. He would take the whole family out. Hey, let's go to the ice cream parlor. Big, fancy ice cream parlor with great big dishes of stuff, you know. But that's not something that's ever going to find its way into a written source. If somebody looks up Vern Miller, you know, they're not going to find the parlor in Jackson, Michigan. When you look at, there are people who have dug into Andrew Borden and taken, for example, Emma's records away at the Young Ladies Seminary and discovered that he paid for small luxuries for her. He paid for carpets in her bedroom, which were extra. There was some type of lesson, I can't remember if it was music or language, that required extra books. It was extra cost for that tuition, and he paid that for her. So although he wouldn't treat himself to luxuries, he would treat his family. And when you think about Lizzie went overseas for, gosh, what was it, weeks and weeks?
19 weeks, yeah.
Yeah. She didn't pay for that out of her pocket. He paid for that. That was, the timing indicates that it was probably her 30th birthday present.
I think Andrew Borden's behavior in business is what made that reputation. Maybe not the way he was with his family, even though the fact that he might have been killed by a family member led to speculations on how cruel and abusive he was in his private life.
Yeah. Well, and everything, you know, when two people turn up dead in the sort of spectacular fashion that Andrew and Abby Borden turn up dead, everything becomes significant suddenly.
Yes.
And when there's so little information available, in addition to that, everything becomes significant. I remember, like, when I was researching the Romanov, I remember coming across some information that Grand Duchess Maria, who's the third daughter of the Tsar, had read this book called The Rosary. She mentioned it, too, in a letter to her father. Oh, I read this book. I liked it. And once that information comes out among the superfans, it then becomes Grand Duchess Maria's favorite book. I'm like, that's not what she said. All we know is that she read it. But because there's no other information about books that person read, we elevate it.
Well, I applaud you for what you've done in your book, which is to navigate through all these myths and all these half-legends and all the trial testimony and everything to try to piece together a comprehensive story where you not only present it in an eloquent, entertaining way that kind of reads like a novel, but also everything is documented, everything is fact-checked, and you are openly honest about the things that we don't know and that may or may not be true. And in regard to the legends of Lizzie Borden, the legends of Andrew Borden, you did a great job in presenting what we currently know about these people and their lifestyle.
Well, thank you. I mean, that is exactly what I wanted to do. And it was not actually always easy to be objective because I do have opinions. And so I could feel myself, you know, when I was recording information or imparting information that aligned with what I believe, there would be this sort of nagging voice saying, okay, now you have to present the other side too. And then, you know, like another little layer is I was trying not to try too hard to present that other side. Because I know what I believe, am I giving too much emphasis to the other side in order to disguise and maintain my objectivity? Am I actually skewing too far in the other direction?
I think a book that has as its goal objectivity, the best you could do is have a chapter about what people's theories are and present the theories factually, saying in this book, this author believes this, and not present it as fact, not present it as your own theory,
right,
not present it as something that you're debunking because you have a theory of your own. I think your book is fine without a chapter like that.
You know, I touched on it a little bit, as you mentioned earlier, you know, with I hopscotch right over of Victoria Lincoln's book. You mentioned that. I mean, she has a very developed theory that's very satisfying. I mean, to read her book is fun because she ties up all those dangling little threads. But because she ties up all those dangling little threads, you realize at some point, this doesn't feel real. This feels like a novel. And that's what I learned with the newspaper accounts. If it read like a story, like, you know, there's this acceleration of emotion and a peak, and there's details that make you, ooh, wow, and then it kind of dips back down and takes you to a resolution. If it feels like that, it probably is a story as opposed to facts. Because if they were trying to relay just what was known, they would have to say, we don't know this, we don't know that. This person says, that person says.
Well, I'm going to ask you the $10 million question. Do you think Lizzie Borden was guilty or innocent?
I do not believe that she murdered Andrew and Abby. I can't prove it by a long shot. I mean, I have to acknowledge, even though that's the way I feel about Lizzie Borden personally, she had the best opportunity to commit that crime. There is no easier solution to the problem than Lizzie Borden. But from Parallel Lives, reading about how she conducted herself after the trial, I really don't think she did it. If you believe sort of the basic outline of that crime, that Lizzie Borden hacked up her parents in order to get her inheritance, that pretty much requires you to believe that Lizzie Borden is a psychopath. That is a psychopathic motive, because these people, they weren't young. They weren't terribly elderly, but she didn't have to wait long. Unless there was a will that we didn't know about, if they were going to get disinherited or something, like, there's really no good reason not to just sit tight for another few years and get your money. She had the equivalent of, I would say, about $74,000 in her own bank accounts at the time of the murders. But after the trial, she lives very quietly. She does indulge herself. She had expensive tastes. I mean, there's no way around that. She enjoyed jewelry. She enjoyed fine clothes. She liked to go to the theater. The house that she and Emma bought after the murder, it was bigger. It wasn't vastly larger. I think it was about 500 square feet larger. They could decorate it in their style. Some people look at that and they feel, well, she took her money, she took her father's money and she went shopping, which is true, but I don't know. It doesn't fit to me.
She also donated to charities like the Animal Rescue League.
And she did so very quietly.
I found out through Parallel Lives that she was even into horse rescue. All the horses, when automobiles came out, all these horses started getting abandoned and abused. And there was a big charitable effort to rescue these horses and take care of them. And for the first time ever, I found out Lizzie Borden owned horses.
There were other little things, like she bought books for the poor. There was one bookseller in town who wouldn't stock, it was, I think, in the 1920s, maybe. Anyway, wouldn't stock an early book on the case because he thought so well of Miss Borden. She bought groceries for pensioners who were not well off. Not staples. She wasn't buying flour and cornmeal. She was buying little luxuries, you know, butter and sugar. Did these people know that Miss Borden was their benefactor? Probably not. She was loaning her car to invalids and shut-ins. Again, did those people, maybe they didn't know that that was Lizzie Borden's car, because how many cars like that were there in town? But, you know, leaving a slice of cake for the coal delivery man, you could argue that all of these are maybe manipulative ways that she's trying to convince people that she didn't do what she did. That's possible. But I would think if that was her goal, she would have been catering to people who had some measure of political or social sway in that community, to be catering to working people, poor people, children, retirees, and not broadcasting her name doesn't fit that psychopathic, manipulative, charming profile. The other thing about the psychopath argument is that a psychopath who's good at it will convince you that they're not guilty. And Lizzie Borden is the furthest thing from that. She did a terrible job of convincing people that she was not guilty. When you look at sort of the profile for psychopathic behavior following a crime, and I say this clearly saying I don't think Bridget Sullivan was a psychopath or that she committed the murders, but in terms of behavior immediately following the crime, the person most likely to be a psychopath is Bridget, because she's reacting the way we want people to react. She's nervous, scared, you know, all sort of shook up, but her testimony is very clear, very fluid, very consistent. And that's what a perpetrator is more likely to do, because they've practiced their story. Where Lizzie, who is viewed as sort of cold and non-reactive, she stirs up more suspicion, because we know that's the inside of a psychopath. That's what we should be scared of. But the trouble with that type of person is they're so adept at disguising it. And Lizzie was not the least bit adept at disguising herself.
That's true. That's true, especially the inquest testimony. I know that she had a dose of morphine in her when she was on the stand, but at the same time, her waffling on things, her self-contradicting, all that was consistent with a person who was innocent and trying to remember what happened that day.
Yeah, but that testimony is just an absolute mess. No matter which side of the divide you stand on, if you read only that testimony, even I have to say, that lady is guilty, because it's so messy. It's just even beyond stumbling to cover your tracks. It's like you've never even thought about leaving tracks, much less covering them.
There was a number of people who, for whatever reason, they believe Lizzie Borden is guilty. And I think that they're the ones who tend to emphasize the myths about the kleptomania, the myths about the sexual abuse by her father, you know, whatever bias confirmation they could find in any small detail that would say, ah, that shows, you know, it's almost as if in their need to believe that she was guilty, they also at the same time have to see her as a victim.
Well, and that's the thing. I think that's part of the mythology of even Abby and Andrew, is if you're going to believe that this woman cut up her parents, you almost have to believe that they deserved it. You need a miserly father. You need a greedy stepmother so that you can stomach the idea of this happening.
There have been many film versions of the Lizzie Borden story. One from the 1970s with Elizabeth Montgomery, The Legend of Lizzie Borden. Recently, there was a made-for-TV movie with Christina Ricci, and that was followed up by a television series. Where do you think these movies fit in with our understanding of Lizzie Borden? Clearly, they were made for entertainment. They were not meant for scholarship. to put it mildly, do you feel that they enhance, they add, they take away? What's your general opinion about these movies?
I'm a pretty poor sport. I have not seen the Elizabeth Montgomery movie. I probably should, because that's such, for so many people, that's how they became aware of Lizzie Borden. I think they epitomize the pop culture thinking, the prevailing caricature of Lizzie Borden. I think the reason I'm such a poor sport is because they do her personally such a disservice. But like the Christina Ricci movie, I was kind of cautiously optimistic when I heard about that, because I thought, Christina Ricci, man, if they gave her any kind of a script with some subtlety in it, boy, she could really do a great job. But they didn't. They just took every Borden myth known to man, threw it in a pot, and stirred it up. And, you know, it is kind of fun to watch. I watched it. I yelled at the TV a little bit. But, you know, she was real. She was a person. Andrew and Abby were people. And whatever happened on the 4th of August ruined/ended three lives. And Emma's too. And you can't imagine that Bridget Sullivan wasn't profoundly affected by what happened in her place of employment. And I just feel like it trivializes a lot of those things.
The book is marketed as a children's book. Schwartz and Wade is an imprint of Random House Children's Books. Was it your intention to start off doing a young adult book about Lizzie Borden?
Yes, they have chosen to market it even a little younger than I'd envisioned, which surprised me a bit. But they had talked with librarians and their marketing team. The input they got was that, yes, you can go even a little younger with this. That's to a large extent why the book feels kind of streamlined, if you will, not going off on certain tangents, just keeping a very clear momentum, which in some ways is limiting because I couldn't put in all the stuff I wanted to put in that I thought was neat, but there's just not room for all of that. And you've got to make some concessions for people who are coming to this for the first time. And not only that, but at a young age, you know, keep it clean. And even the violence itself, I do describe bloody, nasty things, but I don't dwell on them. I just say, this is how it appeared and leave it at that rather than really get in there and revel in it like the TV shows do.
Well, in spite of what you just said, I think the resulting book is an excellent book for adults as well. True, it doesn't read like a full academic biography of Lizzie Borden.
No, but that's a very select audience. How many people want to read an academic biography of Lizzie? Well, you and I do.
Yes.
Every time one comes out, give me one of them.
But in spite of the limitations you just indicated, I think it's an excellent book I would recommend to people of any age.
Well, and there's nothing about like the cover or whatever, except that it doesn't show, archival gory pictures. But there's really nothing about it to indicate this is a book for kids, stay away, grown-ups. As I'm working on it, it's not that often that I'm thinking of, will a kid get this? Maybe in some of the legal procedures that, they might not be familiar with. But on the whole, it's not tremendously different, what an adult would want to know about this case. It's streamlining.
Right. You had a sidebar on the definitions of the different court proceedings. So what's the difference between an arraignment, an inquest, a preliminary hearing, a grand jury?
Right.
But I love that sidebar because it all became clear to me after years of reading about this.
And it was helpful me, too, to actually see why is this, because it feels like, especially if you're reading all those pages and pages of primary sources, like, why are they doing this again? They said this. We've been over this. Oh, because the purpose of this proceeding is different from the purpose of the last proceeding.
Yes.
And you really get a clear look at how the justice system is supposed to work. From that sidebar, here's the procedure. Here's what each thing is trying to accomplish and or prevent.
So tell us a little bit about your most current book project that you're working on now.
The Dion quintuplet.
Yes.
The Dions were the first set of quintuplets that were known to survive ever as a complete set. They also, to my knowledge, remain the only ever known identical set of quintuplets. They were five baby girls born in Ontario in 1934. And they became, the public was immediately captivated by these tiny little babies who shouldn't have survived. They were born in a farmhouse that had no plumbing, no electricity, and they were bitsy. They were like, in round numbers, they were about 2 pounds a piece. They were born at probably 7 months, but they did live, and it got really messy really fast because the parents were not able to provide the care that premature infants need, because who is? Especially times five. They need incubators. They needed donated mother's milk. They needed round-the-clock nursing because their lungs weren't fully developed, and they needed stimulation from oxygen to keep them from just fading away. So the government's solution was to take custody of these children and build them a special private hospital across the road and bring them up there in what some people view as captivity. And they were put, they had a playground that had an observatory around it so people could come and see them. It was theoretically one-way windows, but they knew. Eventually, the girls were aware that they were being looked at. Part of the reason for that separation from their parents is their father, in kind of a panic in the first week after they were born, signed a contract with the Chicago World's Fair to exhibit them when they were well enough to be moved. But people were just up in arms that these babies were going to be put into a freak show, essentially. And then the government stepped in, took them away, and put them in a freak show, until they were about 10 years old. It was a ridiculous story.
What drew you to this story? What got you interested in it?
Well, this is going to be the dumbest story ever. I have in the attic these little bitty plastic dolls that had nothing to do with the Dions, to my knowledge, but they were quintuplet dolls. They were just a couple inches tall, and there was a little set of five of them. They were like from Tyco or something in the 80s. For some reason, I thought, I think I have a set or two of those. I wonder if they're worth anything. So I went on to eBay or Etsy or something to see if these were worth selling, and I found the Dion and went, wow, that's interesting. I was aware of the Dions a little bit because my grandma on my mother's side loved everything about the 1930s that you were supposed to love, like the Dions and Shirley Temple and Judy Garland and Betty Davis. So I was vaguely aware of them. But when I saw some of the memorabilia that was for sale online, I started looking and looking and looking. And I ordered 3 books from the library and I read them all on a weekend and away I went.
That's not so dumb a story. That's a pretty cool story.
It's completely unintentional, but you know, that's how it happened.
It shows the power of eBay to inspire us. Are any of the Dions still alive today?
There are 2 still living. Annette and Cecile just turned 82 over Memorial Day weekend.
We've been talking to Sarah Miller, the author of The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century, published by Random House Children's Books. Sarah is the author of 2 novels, Miss Spitfire, Reaching Helen Keller, and The Lost Crown, a novel about the Romanoffs. Thank you very much, Sarah, for your time.
Thank you. It's been fun.
And we hope to see you again next week when we talk about the Lizzie Borden Primer.
Looking forward to it.
You have been listening to the Lizzie Borden Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Behrens. This podcast was written and produced by 9 Muses Books and engineered by Mason Amadeus. The theme music was composed and performed by Melora Krieger. The Lizzie Borden Podcast is sponsored by 9 Muses Books and the Lizzie Borden Girl Detective Mystery Series. More information can be found at www.lizziebordenpodcast.com and www.lizziebordengirldetective.com.